Application number 16808, Wheel 2.
Pickles Rail 2.
So on the mocked-up transporters, what I call big lorries, the commander would stand on the back of the platform of the lorry, and the driver would lean forward so he could see him, and the commander would give the driver the word that he was now level with the ramps and could go up safely. The only trouble was then that when the driver started going up, and they were quite steep, he needed to be able to judge his revs correctly to go up, because there was no way he wanted to stall or have to slide back. He never knew what would have happened if that had happened. And so you drove up, and initially you could see the commander, who was giving you the come on with both hands, you're okay, come on. And you're revving up, you're driving up in bottle gear. But gradually, as you get higher, he disappears, the lorry disappears, and the back of the lorry cab disappears, and all you can see is the sky because of the angle you are going up the ramps. So you're now totally responsible for judging those revs and feeling, and this is something that is indescribable really, but a tank commander feels where he is when he can't see to judge his revs. It's something that a lorry driver never experiences. But a tank driver has to have this feel to know when he reaches the peak of the climb, to know when to lower himself down with controlled revs and not keep driving, because if he does, he'll slam down the other side of the point of balance, and whatever it is, it depends what damage he does, you see. In this case, if he'd have slammed down on the back of one of these lorries, which were obviously, as I say, mocked-up transporters, I think he would have went straight through the timbers. So you had to judge this, and then, of course, you came down onto the back of the lorry, and you then looked at the back of the cab. You just drove forward to the point where you had to stop, and then you change you down for transporting, you see. Well, then, of course, you had to wind these ramps up again, and they used to go up, they stood straight up in the air, one either side of the vehicle, and as I say, the springs were not, in my opinion, strong enough for the job. It was just a mocked up thing, as I keep saying. And when you went along the road, the roads were arterial, so they had this camber on them, and they used to drive in the centre as far as possible, but they needed to go over onto the camber when they met traffic or let people come by, you see, these lorries. But what happened then, you had this horrible feeling that it leaned over so much. I mean, the Valentine tank wasn't a big heavy tank by comparison of later vehicles, but it was the biggest one at that time, sort of thing. And you're talking probably about 15-16 ton. I think that was about the maximum weight of a Valentine tank. But it was quite a big thing at that time, you see. When the lorry had to come off the centre of the road, so the near side went down into the gully, as it were, you had this alarming lean over. You sort of thought, Christ, any minute you're going to just topple completely over. But I don't know of any that did, you know, but it was a horrible experience. And we were glad when we didn't have to use them very often, you know. But occasionally they did, because they didn't want us to drive on our tracks on the roads from where we were at Stoke-on-Quay up to Thetford through Bury St Edmunds on the road, you see, because our battle tracks, they used to rip roads up, you know, no problem. And of course, one of the things that happened before the war, we started to get these cat's eyes in the middle of the road. And they used to come out like bullets when the tracks went over them, because they were only set in sort of a rubber thing. And it wasn't long before there were literally no cat's eyes left in the country, I don't think. Wherever there were tanks, the cat's eyes all disappeared. They just dragged them out of the things. And they used to come out like bullets. They used to ping all over the place initially, till they were gone, like you see. And but wherever we went, of course, from that point of view, we created chaos. And so when we used to come off the areas at Thetford, We used to come down onto the road. When they got so many tanks down, we used to have to stop, and we used to have to carry a yard brush with us to clear the road of all the debris we left behind, the dirt and the mud and the tufts of earth and all that, you see. Otherwise, ordinary vehicles, commercial vehicles, motorbikes and things like that, I mean, there'd have been chaos we'd have left behind us, you see. So when they used to come off, you motored so for sort of a few hundred yards, by which time you chucked all this stuff off, you see. And then you just had to stop the tanks and go back and sweep it all up and sweep it into the side, out the road, you see. It made it difficult for training, really. And the same with, you had to open and shut gates and things like that, you know. So it was rather funny. But it was better later on when we got bigger tanks, where you had a co-driver, because his job then used to be to jump out and open the gate and jump back in again. Somebody else, the last tank, could jump out and shut the gate. And things like that, you see. And but we got through that that year with the Valentines. And then in the end of 1941, we went into winter quarters at Brandon in Suffolk. And we had a sort of a Nissen hut barracks. Are all Nissen huts, and we had a bad winter. Well, not a bad winter, we had a bad time through that winter. The worst winter we had, of course, was 1939. Everywhere in the country was snowbound that winter. And as I say, digressing a little bit, going back, we were, as I said before, we were at Witten Aerodrome, and they had Blenheim bombers at that time, and they were grounded for weeks with snow. They couldn't get off the aerodrome at all. And what they did, they placed them out all over the area and lashed them down. And we used to have these little half-sized Nissen nuts, which were dotted about the aerodrome. And we were that short of staff, with the squadrons having to do these extra coverage, just one squadron, that what they used to do was give a watch, a service watch, pocket watch, to three men. And we'd got a half-track vehicle, and I think it was about the only vehicle that could go anywhere around the aerodrome off the roads. You know, they cleared the roads for the rear vehicles, but to go out to these isolated things, they didn't clear the snow. They just, well, we used to go around with their half-track vehicle, what we called a slave carrier, and we could go all over the aerodrome, that, you see. So we used to put three men to each aeroplane in one of these little half-sized Nissen nuts with a ballast stove and two hay boxes, one with sandwiches and one with tea, which by the morning after opening and shutting it so many times, you had to sort of scuff the top to get at the tea underneath, because it was like a thick scum on the top, like, you know. And I often think our stomachs must have been ruined forever. But we used to put three men out, you see, with a watch, and they used to decide among themselves, like when it was whose turn to go out and guard this aeroplane, you see. And the whole aerodrome was grounded for weeks because of the snow and the bad winter. But so when we was at Brandon, we had a similar thing that, I don't know how long it lasted now, but I know at one time we had to have, each troop had to supply a duty, two duty men, and their job was every given time, say 10 minutes or 15 minutes, they had to get in, start the tank up and move it, because we had periods of the tank tracks freezing to the ground. And of course, once they froze, you got rubber wheels, rubber tracks on the wheels, so you couldn't sort of think, well, pour some petrol down, set light, and that'd free them, you see. Well, you couldn't do that, you set the wheels on fire. So we had to, for a period, we had to have a period where the chaps would get in, start the tanks up, drive it forward a length, and then next time they drive it back, you see. And this was happening all through the night on all the vehicles, so they didn't get froze to the ground. And of course, during the day, we carried on our normal routine, whatever we did, you see. But yes, we had a bad period there where we had to do that. But we were in this Nissen hut at camp, and we had a large hut, like a extra large bit Nissen hut, which we used as a sort of regimental for concerts or lectures or whatever like that, you see. And it used it as a canteen, like it wasn't a true naffy, like, you know, we still hadn't got a true naffy experienced, like, you know. And at that time, we used to use Lakenheath as our training area, which was just down the road from Brandon, you see. And Barton Mills and all that, all round there, you see, was Lakenheath. And Mildenhall was the RAF aerodrome, just up the road. And the RAF used to share Lakenheath, where the American aerodrome was built. And we used to share it with the RAF as a training area. We had it on certain periods for tank training, and the RAF had it for certain periods for bombing. And they used to come in with these bombers and drop dummy bombs, you see. And then they used to have squads out digging them up again. And so we used to share it with them. Well, then the Americans came in the war while we were down there, you see, 1941. And then it went into 1942, you see, the spring, and the Americans, they started building this aerodrome, which is there now, of course. And so we lost it. We had to go further out into Thetford Heath proper for training, and the RAF, I don't know what they did for bombing, but anyway, they built this aerodrome. It was rather funny because it just shows you the attitude, military attitude, of Britain compared to basically, I don't know about the rest of the world, whether I should use that word, but by comparison, the Americans particularly. Now, if the British set up an establishment, especially during a war, of a camp, I build a camp to accommodate the personnel, the vehicles. And the last thing they think of, if it's convenient, it's got to be convenient, it's not a necessity, I build a naffy for your comforts. Now, they're building this aerodrome at Lakenheath for the Americans, and they fly in American Labour Corps, you see, who were coloured. That's the first time I saw coloured Americans. And they flew in this Labour Corps of Americans to build the aerodrome with local contractors. And they were building concrete roads and the bays for the aeroplanes, you see. And they were all living in Nissen, in bell tents, all these people. The first stone-built building the American labourers built was a PX. That was the first stone-built thing, establishment, on that aerodrome at Lakenheath, was a PX for comfort. But with the British, naffy would have been a last thing because it's not essential. But PX is essential to the Americans. And that was the first stone building built on that aerodrome by the Americans, was a PX. But anyway, that was our introduction to Americans while I was down at Brandon. And we had some funny laughs, you see, because we hadn't initially, the Americans that came over were Air Force. And there wasn't enough of them initially to create this atmosphere of animosity. We were friendly. And we mixed a lot with these chaps from, because we used to go down to Brandon Railway Station, which was only like a halt, really, but it wasn't a big station. And when the war came, I said, they started having these big passenger trains in length, stopping there for the forces personnel, because all the way around that area were all the British formation, the artillery and everybody else, you see, and the 1st Yeomanry, 2nd Yeomanry, Gloucesters were there, Royal Horse Artillery, and all these associated units belonging to the division, you see. And well, then the 1st Army Division went abroad, went out to the Middle East. And while we were down there, we became part of the 6th Army Division, which was the Male Fist. The 1st Army Division was a rhinoceros, a white rhinoceros on a black background. And I understand that when it got out to the Middle East in the desert, where you had nicknames for badges, they were nicknamed the Pregnant Pig Division because of this rhinoceros. Well, we became then the 6th Army Division while we were down that area, and we had a mailed fist, which was a white mailed fist on a black background. And we used to use Brandon Station, you see, to get in and out of Cambridge. And of course, the Americans did the same, you see. And so we then became associated to the Americans. And they, I read one of these books, I don't remember much of it, but I read it. Each one of these Americans was given a handbook of courtesy. How to deal with the native British servicemen and civilians, you see. And one of the things was that they expressly pointed out in this thing that the British serviceman wore what was known as a battle dress, and that we had been fighting a war for 2 years, and we were now rather staid people. You know, we were beginning to get stale, and we were not so fresh and lively as we had been in 1939, you see. And all we had was these battle dresses. And it said, if you upset them, they will be quite prepared to do battle. So do not upset the local troops, you see. As compared to the Americans, having two or three suits, looking very flesh and swish, you see. And things like that were in this book, you see. And they knew that when they came over, they initially, most of them had got about three medals, you see, one for going abroad, and they'd all got medals for, because they'd done their rifle training or their pistol training, they gave them a medal for doing that, you see. We didn't, but they did, you see. So when they came over, they'd always initially got two or three medals, like you say, ribbons. And we, none of us had got any, you see, because we hadn't done anything, you see. Well, we had a bit of a gimmick, you see, and one of our cooks, chap lap named Paul, he got the three ribbons from the First War. What do they call them? Pipsqueak and Wilfred, you see. It's probably his father's or something. And he carried these three ribbons, you see. And these Americans, I've said this because I've got American friends who come over and visit us. When they they said at one time, they said, what is it you like about the Americans, Reg? I said, well, I think the fascination and the thing that makes them comfortable with us is the fact that you've never grown up yet. He said, how do you mean? I said, well, let's face it. I said, we have a history 2,000 years old. I said, and yours is about 200. So I said, to us, your attitude, you don't realise it probably, but the way you come over to us, you're still learning, you're still novices, you haven't grown up. I said, I mean, go back 100 years, you're cowboys and Indians. I said, and you're still living that. Your character is still living, cowboys and Indians. I said, you're still children to us. And he said, you're probably right, Reg. He said, I'll accept that. It's America for old Rich, you know. But they were, in that their approach was very childish almost, you know. They were so enthusiastic, wanted to look at everything, you know. And so we soon learned that they were very gullible. And old Paulie, we used to get on the train, you see, and of course there were single compartments in the trains those days. It was only the main lines that had the corridor train, you see. So all the way along the train was all these big handles all the way along. You got in sort of 8 or 10 in a compartment, you see. So when you got in, that was it. And you were stuck until the end of the journey. And if you wanted to go to the toilet, it was open the window, like you see. And so old Paulie, he got there, you see, and we'd be talking, and we'd always make sure we got him mixed with the Americans, you see. And we're going to Cambridge for the night. And they'd be talking to these Americans, like, talk with each other, and then you gradually start to talk to each other. And inadvertently, quite accidentally, old Paulie would drop these ribbons on the floor, you see. And these Americans knew that was one of the things in this book. Don't ask anything about medals, because we hadn't got any. And if a man had got a ribbon, it was an individual award for valour of some sort, you see. So he would inadvertently drop these three men, and we'd take no notice, so we wouldn't. And so one of the youngsters said, "Excuse me, guy," he said, "I think you just rubbed some of it." And one of the, not Paulie, one of the lads would say, "What? Paulie, you dropped your ribbons again. Look, you don't wear them, you'll get into trouble. You know what'll happen, you'll be in the bloody glass house if you don't wear them." And say, "Well, no, I can't wear them with it amongst the lads." He said, "These youngsters say, you got ribbons?" And they say, "Well, yeah, but," and I would say, "No, you've got to tell us about that. Now, how did you get those ribbons?" And they said, "Well, no." They said, "Go on, Paulie, tell them you've been out in the Middle East and that, you know. Tell them you've been brought back to train us lads and that, you know." And they give them a load of cobblers, like you say. And be free beer all night, you say, in Cambridge. And just one of the little amusing incidents. And another incident, the train used to come back from Cambridge. And because the platform could only get about four coaches on it, by now these trains would be nearly a mile long, some of them, you know. And so you've got four coaches on the platform and about a dozen out in the country, you see. And so what we used to do is go all down to Brandon and buy a penny platform ticket. Nobody bought a railway ticket. You bought a penny platform ticket. See, in those days, to go on a railway station, you paid a penny. I mean, if you were going to see a friend off on the train, they bought a railway ticket, you bought a penny platform ticket, and then when the train had gone, you came off, you see, when you showed them your ticket. Or you gave them your penny platform ticket, you see. And of course, the conditions continued during the war, so when you went down the station, you bought a penny platform ticket and got on the train to Cambridge. So when you got to Cambridge, you see, you got all sorts of scars, and you've got to get out the doings, otherwise you'd have to pay at that end, you see. But we never used to, we could always avoid it, you see. And then the thing was, one night they decided to do a thing about it, and they got all the red caps down there. And of course, that used to be a game, because the station people themselves used to try to judge and to catch some of the lads. They would arrange for the train to stop with the first three or four coaches on the station. And next time, it'd be the last three or four coaches on the station. So when you got on with the penny platform ticket, you never knew whether you was going to be on the station or in the country, you see. If you was in the country, you just got out and walked away across the fields. And I remember one night, they got all the red caps there, all the way along, to try to get them. And talk about knocking an ant's nest over. When the train stopped, the door flew out and people flew out all over the place. And these red caps are trying to collar people, or, you know. I don't know what success they had, because I didn't collar them anyway. But one of the little episodes at Brandon. Well, while we were there, another thing happened. Singapore fell while we were there. And there's always been stories about who was to blame, why it fell. The story about all the guns were pointing out to sea. There was no preparation for a land attack and all that, you see. Well, I don't want to go into all that, but one of the things was that they were such a kerfuffle about the fact that there was more troops surrendered than were attacking Singapore. That there were less Japanese than there were Australians, British and Commonwealth troops, you know. And you think, well, it was the biggest disgrace that we've ever had, you know, that our forces should surrender to a smaller number of attackers. So anyway, they got to blame it under somebody, and they said that the morale of the troops was so low due to the fact that they were having such an easy life. They weren't fit, and the fibre wasn't there, you know, sort of, well, we'll pack up, you know, and all that, you see. And while we were there, they decided that they'd have a get-fit campaign. And so the order came out that, I don't know about everybody else, but from our regiment, we, in our squadron, which was at Brandon, just up the road, on the Thetford Road, we, in this camp, had got to run and walk 3 miles. And then when we got back, we go straight onto the butts, because we had our own butts, you know. All they were metal plates, you know, on a sort of a mocked up thing, just so we could do some firing practice. and which we didn't do a lot of because we were a tank unit, you see. But anyway, they decided that we got to do this mile and a half, get fit. No, 3 miles, three miles, run and walk, you see, in 20 minutes. And we had small pack respirators, steel helmets, and skeleton webbing, like you say, and a rifle with 50 rounds, a bandolier, cloth bandolier of 50 rounds, you see. And I mean, we weren't riflemen, like you say. Got no idea about doing 3 miles. I mean, we never marched 3 miles, you know. Anyway, I decided that from our camp down to the railway station at Brandon and back to the camp was 3 miles. Well, when you went into Brandon, you went down a hill to the station, and then you had to come up a hill through the town back, you see. And it was a shambles. God, you know, I mean, young men, you sort of think you're reasonably fit to a degree. But this was a totally shambles, it was, you know. God, blokes were dropping out all over the place. They got a lorry behind chucking them in at the back, you know. And I don't know of anybody who was fit enough to hold a rifle steady enough to fire at the butts, let alone hit them, you know. But anyway, they then had to get it organised, and they brought the muscle men in, as we called them, the physical training corps, you see. We always called them muscle men, you see. And strangely enough, they was always little people. They weren't, you'd expect them to be 6 foot as fit as, you know, and they was always little tiny people compared to us even, you know. We weren't big them days. I mean, I was 5'9", and my grandson's over the top of me, but I was quite tall, and you know, for 5'9" in those days. And so they brought these muscle men in, and what they did was to run and walk in troops to the slowest man. And so he would trail arms, you see, and march. And then they say, right, slow arms, and you'd march properly, you see. And then you'd trail your arms again, and you'd run. And they got us at the finish, so they was running with the rifles across your chest, you see. And we're still doing this down to there and back. And at the end of about 6 weeks, I think, we had to run past a raised dais. I suppose it was the brigadier or somebody, some brass hats were on there. And we ran, we marched to the point up the road to Elverdon Crossroads, on the main road from Newmarket, I think it is, to what do you call it, begins with a B. I mentioned it before, actually. Anyway, it was on the main road, Elverdon Crossroads. It's a very prominent crossroads, and I believe these days it's a very dangerous crossroads for traffic. And but at that point, it was a mile and a half, as I understood it, from there, where we marched to, up to Elverdon Crossroads and back was 3 miles, you see. And so they, at the end of this period, when we, well, now we'd become fit. We didn't realise it, but we'd become fit, you see. Got all this kit on. And we marched to this point, and then we ran in troops, you see, and just bum, 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 bum. And we went up to the crossroads, turned, and trotted back, you know, at the double. And then as we coming up to the saluting base, we stopped. We trailed arms, got in the step, sloped arms, and marched. I was right, and we marched by the saloon. And we were doing it, this business, in 18 minutes. It's 3 miles. Well, honestly, within a month, we couldn't have done it again. We'd dropped back to our old unfit state, as you might say. But it was amazing, and I've never forgotten it. In about 6 weeks, we could do that 3 miles.
Was the place beginning with Barton Mills? Barton Mills, was it?
No, from Brandon, the town, and we turned up the road to Elverdon Crossroads, which is on the main road from to Berris Nedmans, isn't it? From Thetford to Berris Nedmans, I believe. I think that's where Elverdon Crossroads is. But anyway, it's on that main road. But from the point at Brandon up to the crossroads and back was considered to be 3 miles, see? And we ran that and back. We did it in the time after we trained, you know, over a period of about 6 weeks. And that was only because they tried to blame the fall of Singapore on the low morale and condition, physical condition, of the troops, the garrison troops, totally overlooking the fact that we know now that Australian regiments were coming in off the ship and going straight into captivity, which had nothing to do with morale. I mean, they landed raring to fight anybody. You give them a couple of pints of beer, they'd have fought themselves, you know, didn't matter who they was. But that was the blame that came back to us when we was at Brandon, that it was the low fibre morale and fitness of the troops that allowed the fall to happen. But anyway, being very much. And then, of course, we finished up then.